Hello, this is Wampum.Codes, and I'm your host, Amelia Winger Bearskin. We are brought to you with generous support from the Mozilla Foundation and MIT Co-Creation Studio. Today I wanted to do a special shout out because I wanted to make some Wampum.Codes swag to give out to my wonderful guests, and an amazing company here in the East Bay is helping me out, and I wanted to give them a special shout out so that we can support local businesses. I live in Oakland, and I want to give a shout out to AMP Printing in Dublin, California. It's a woman-owned commercial print shop, and it has staff open working during our pandemic crisis in CDC and WHO directed safe work environments. They print postcards, brochures, anything that you can put a logo on, they can print it. Call Tammy at 925-248-8268 or T-A-M-I-N at ampprinting.com. I have an amazing guest with me today, and I've known her for a while. She's one of my favorite people. I will let her introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Eve LaFountain, or I could say, I suppose my whole name, which is long, which is maybe fun. So the whole name is Eve Lauren Littleshell Chavalea LaFountain, which includes so many tribes.
That's awesome.
Which doesn't even include my adult name, actually, which is Miknakmenadu Ikwe, which means turtle spirit woman. I'm Turtle Mountain Chippewa of the Bear Clan, and I'm also Jewish, so we have so much in common.
I know. I have, like, you know, people always ask me, they're like, do you know any other Native American Jews? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
There's, like, a few. I mean, I think it's so funny. I get that all the time, too, and I grew up with a few, so it didn't seem so weird. Like, I went to preschool at my temple, and I feel like probably a third of my class was, like, little brown Jewish kids.
That's amazing.
But I also grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, so
yeah.
That's probably where you're going to find the majority of Native American Jews. Yeah, and it works out in so many ways because my mom is Jewish, so, like, you know, according to that side of Judaism, it works. And my tribe, our clan, is passed down through our father's side.
Oh,
so
wow.
Technically, I'm fine in either way. I'm not, like, homeless as far as lineage goes, which is pretty amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad they planned that pretty well.
Yeah, they got that. So they were like, check, very good. Bear clan, I can live with that, check.
Yeah, protectors.
That's amazing. Yeah, my both of my parents are, you know, matriarchal. So my father's Jewish, my mother's Native American. Our clans are passed down from the woman, and we're a matriarchal, matrilineal Confederate democracy. So I'm like very squarely on the Native side. And, you know, as my friends will say, well, it's nice your dad's Jewish. So, like, yep. Yep, that's them. Yeah,
it does work out pretty well. Yeah, I always think that naming is so interesting, and I think I always have a hard time introducing myself with thinking about which names to include and what I'm talking about. And I think when I was about 13, I started going by, like, a hyphenated first and middle Eve Lauren. Which then became kind of my internet persona because I was hiding from a whole other side of my middle school trauma life.
Thank God for the internet.
Yeah, well, I was trying to hide from the internet because people knew my full name from this crazy TV show that I was on, and I needed to, like, not be that. So yeah. Now suddenly my artist name, because I wanted to be, like, removed from that, my artist name became this, like, Eve-Lauren, even though that's not my actual first name, but it makes it harder to find me on the internet, which is nice.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. Do you feel comfortable telling us what crazy TV show you're on?
It's sure. Okay. Yeah, I think I was thinking about it because I was just talking about it to one of my cousins. I was on this show called Bug Juice.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I love that show.
That's the reaction I get most of the time, which is kind of amazing now in retrospect.
Yeah. That's also kind of ridiculous how you look the same now that I think about it.
Do people also tell you that too?
Yeah, as soon as they like know, they're like, oh, I know exactly who you are. Wow.
No, it's so true because like I always just felt like you looked familiar, but then I was like, you know, you're kind of like you're Jewish Native American. Maybe there's just like a look that we have.
Maybe there's just some sort of look.
Maybe it's just some kind of look, you know? And I'm like, maybe she looks like my sister or something. But no, you just look like that girl from Buck Juice.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I used to watch that show with my little sister.
Cool.
Very cute. You're and, well, and what a fun part, because it was, like, so spunky and weird, and you're still spunky and weird, so they captured you, the good casting there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's, like, it was before reality TV was a thing, and I've been thinking about it a lot lately in the last couple of years, I guess, as an experience that I tried to hide from for basically my entire existence after it happened. So yeah, I think that I've been hearing about it a lot and thinking about different kinds of trauma based on like internet bullying and experiences. And like in the back of my mind, there's always been some sort of, I don't know, project back there about the experience or essay or writing, something. Something's going to happen about it. I'm not sure what form it's going to take yet, but
yeah,
it's a thing. It's nice that it like brings joy to people now though.
Sure. I mean, sure. I can't really imagine what it is like to be that famous, that young. I was one of those music people that started touring the world at a very young age doing opera. But when you walk down the street, Nobody stops me and is like, weren't you in the Rigoletto in Vienna? You know, like it's not, you know, like, I'm not
I
like,
wish a, they would.
I mean, a god. I mean, you know, a couple of times in my life, I was in a cafe and someone would come up to me, you know, like twice, you know, like that's about it. You know, it's very, and of course they're like the nerdiest people that are like very unfrightening, who are just like, oh, I just wanted to let you know. And then you're like, great, you know. And I have had other, as I got older, when I became an artist, is when I got like the super weird stalkers that came out of the woodwork. But luckily when I was a child, I didn't get those. I got the nerdy music type, like classical music nerds. Fine. It's totally what you need as like a 12-year-old. It's about all you can handle is like a weird old guy being like, very good. but I can't imagine. I cannot even imagine. And I'm glad that you were able to find a cool internet haven like so many of us did in middle school to hide from the world.
Well, I mean, I think it really made my relationship with the internet very unusual compared to most people who are like hanging out in AOL chat rooms. Yeah. And this is something that you would probably, given your artistic interests, would be a great person to brainstorm about how to like make this into some sort of interesting project. I had these crazy experiences where I would be like in an AOL chat room at like 14 years old and people would be like, stop pretending to be me. I'm the real Eve. And I was like, but I'm the real Eve. And they were like, no, I'm Eve from Bug Juice. I go to this high school in Santa Fe. This is my full name. This is how old I am. This is my birthday. And I was like, oh my God, they know all these things about me. And for a while, and they would have screen names that were like very similar to mine, which was like Rainbow Bright 107.9, right? Because I was obsessed with Rainbow Bright.
Of course, I mean, same, obviously. Freaking amazing show. I mean,
my hero.
To this day.
Yeah, that's not in the past. And they would have screen names that were like almost exactly like mine, and they would be like, you're running around the internet pretending to be me. And so there's like this whole thing with people, because you know, nobody had like profile pics or whatever.
Yeah, which was a very interesting time.
Yeah, so people were just pretending to be whoever they wanted, and a lot of people were, like, saying that they were me, and eventually I just remember, like, I was so horrified by the experience that I was like, okay, fine, you're Eve, that's fine, I'm faking, I'm never going on the internet again,
yeah.
And, like, signed off from, like, the AOL world, like, all those things when so many friends were like first getting into that. And I just wonder, like, would my relationship with technology and social media and all that stuff be like totally different had I not had this bizarre situation of people like trying to like consume my identity when I was like really little. It's fascinating. Because I was a little kid. I was like 14, you know?
I barely knew who the hell I am. And then, you know, like other people know who I am though, and they are me.
And I was like, are they going to like, because, you know, all the stories were like, don't tell anybody your full name on the internet. Like, don't tell them where you live because they're going to come and murder you or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get like abducted. Like, I don't know what's going on. And I eventually just like signed off from all that stuff and like kind of went on a weird, I like didn't do anything with the internet for most of high school because of that. So I had like this very strange relationship to the internet and the social world. So then I started having like my artist name be a combination of more of my name, with like these hyphens and kind of like weird spellings and hard way, like harder to find actual me, which I think is funny because I feel so uncomfortable when people say like, oh, this is like Eve Lauren, because I don't go by that in real life.
Right.
Just go by the shortest part of the name. So yeah, anyway, that's a tangent that I wasn't expecting, but it's on my mind because my cousin was just talking to me about it. He's like, my son was not believing that you're a TV star. I was like, that's fine, nobody believes me anymore.
Yeah, you're like, I actually, even in this AOL chat, I'm not even her anymore. Somehow that happened. Like, wouldn't that be, that would be an amazing story that like you accidentally end up in the wrong chat room and you're no longer yourself and someone else is, you know, like that's kind of what happened. So
this really, it's like a very strange disembodied feeling of somebody like accusing you of not being you.
Yeah.
And like, what do you do? You're like, okay, I guess I'll like you're gonna fight me harder than I care to fight with identity. So
yeah, especially on the internet, you're like, no one's okay.
Yeah, very strange. Now I guess that's kind of common for like celebrities to have people claiming to be their famous Instagram accounts or whatever, but
yeah. And I mean, I once had this friend who he took really strange side jobs, and he had like some agency had connected him to this billionaire who wanted him to set up an HTC Vive in her bedroom, which is like, you know, you're like an artist in New York and you're just like, okay, I mean, I'll take this side gig. And he's definitely the kind that would like lean into the weird ones, you know, for sure. And so he gets there and he sets it all up and he puts her into, I think, Altspace. And she was just like, this is the greatest thing in the whole world. I get to just wander around all of these rooms talking with people as this like generic avatar and no one knows who I am. And she was just like, loved it because she could be anonymous and interact with people that she actually couldn't interact with on a daily basis, which I, you know, she could, come on. I mean, like, just cause you're a billionaire doesn't mean, what, are you not going to go to the grocery store? I don't know. Well, like, okay, whatever.
I wouldn't know.
I mean, I don't know. So I don't know, but like, I guess maybe she can't do that. I don't know. Anyways, I thought that was very interesting that she felt like being in VR was the closest thing to being in reality for her, right?
Wow.
Which is weird, right?
Very weird.
And then I, of course, like, you brought up a lot of interesting concepts around early internet, right? Because, like, no one knew what we looked like. You didn't have voice. It was all over chat with your name. So maybe if your name is Rainbow Bright, they might think you're a girl, but maybe not. And it's just, it's all very, you know, you are who you say you are. I was very young, and at a fairly good, decent hacker and going in all of these like anonymous hacker groups. And yeah, no, I don't think anyone ever knew I was a girl, you know, or especially that I was like under 18 and a girl and just like very young, dumb child. Or, and then I don't know if all those other people might've also been girls that are 12 and like, just like me, like, I don't know. We all had like the most basic OPSEC names, you know, that could no way be tied to any identifier. You know, we really believed in this, the freedom of anonymity and that being anonymous was our, like, it was our ethos and our belief system and all that kind of crazy stuff. I do miss that sometimes about the internet, like the that it could just be about the conversation that I'm having with someone or the things that we're sharing or the whatever weird code thing we're building. I don't know.
Well, also just the like idea of being able to go into some space where you felt like you weren't supposed to be there and like be as anonymous as you want to be and to make up an identity. And I mean, I think at the time I was convinced that everybody else was like actually a grown up, but like now, you know, in 2020 hindsight, I think probably every single person who was in an AOL chat room at that time was also like a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah, totally.
Is totally. My guess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, cause they're like, women, in like their 30s, I'm going to say, are like the only people that have clear memories of doing that basically at this point.
It's so true.
I'm just convinced that we were all like 12 to 15-year-old girls talking to each other, pretending that we were like dudes or pretending that we were something else. It's like kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. I remember one time I was in a Buffy the Vampire Slayer room on AOL. Cool. And someone said, everybody in the chat room, try to call this radio because they're doing a quiz where if you get the right trivia about the show right, you'll win this thing, and the collective wants to win this thing. So everybody call, like if you have an extra line, because obviously we're on dial-up internet. So like if you have an extra line, okay, use it to call in the show. And I was the one that got it. And I did not know very much trivia about this show, like, to be honest. Like, I liked the show, but I'm not one of those people that knows the actors' names or, like, where they're from. Or, you know, like, the trivia stuff. Like, who?
And also, like, how are you supposed to know that before the internet had all that stuff ready available?
Right. So I was like, shit. You know, and I get on the phone. He's like, okay, or what's your name? And I'm like, I'm Amelia. And he's like, well, who is the person who, or what's the band that wrote the theme song for the show? And I'm like, oh, and I'm like, just like typing in the group. And then they're like, they're all listening to the radio and they're feeding me the like answers collectively of the like 200 women that are on the- We totally won, even though like none of the answers I knew. It was just like this collective thing. And then the thing that he was going to give me, somehow we wanted it. I don't remember what it was. Or they just wanted the clout, right? The, so that at the end of the interview, I had to like shout out my group, you know, totally for the, you know, just the clout.
But, yeah, well, I mean, because at that time, like chat rooms and also the radio were like huge media outlets. Like, right? MTV was still trying to be cool, but it was like not super relevant, at least in my world, because they played, you know, trash.
Yeah, and like I didn't even have cable, right? Like I didn't have cable, but I had the internet and I had the radio. So, and it was funny that the radio quiz trivia people aren't, I don't know, they wouldn't even assume that you could get online to look up those answers because so few people were on. Remember how on AOL you had to be like on the World Wide Web section or the Gopher and you could like actually query the internet? It's like, what? It's so weird.
Like, there was no way to like search something on the
right
internet.
Oh yeah, this is pre-Google, right? So yeah, so you just had to get it from like 200 ladies that are like, I know who it is.
Right, but like some of them say they're 16-year-old boys.
Of course, well, yes. I mean, obviously, everyone.
Like, they all lived in California.
Yeah, of course. Like,
everybody lives in California and they're 16.
Yeah.
Which is like, literally none of them were like 16-year-old Californians.
Thank you for demystifying that for me. I just thought as a New Yorker that everyone else in the world lived in California.
No, literally I was sitting in New Mexico like, oh, I'm 16 and I live in California. Or no, I live in Cali.
Ooh, like, nice. Insider speak.
Cali, that's like the one way that you know that you don't actually live there.
I mean, I do say that to troll my boyfriend. I'm like, I say Cali, I say SF, and I say San Fran, just to upset him. Just to hurt him deeply. Yeah, I know I'm a bad person.
Yeah, yeah. I think that funny. My partner would also like cringe and maybe just die.
But like as a New Yorker, I have to have a thick skin, you know, because people are like, the Big Apple, and I'm like, ah, that's amazing. Like I just think it's funny, you know, like no one could say anything about New York City that would make me feel like offended. It would just be adorable. I don't know.
Yeah, when I first moved out of New Mexico, everybody was like, where? Or, you speak such good English. And they would be like, oh, I've been to Arizona, which is next to Texas. I'm like, no, there's a state in the middle. It's like pretty big, and that's where I'm from. Oh my God. There. It's that like hole in the middle that you don't remember exists. And now everybody wants to move to Santa Fe. And,
I mean, of course.
Be like a crystal shaman or whatever. So.
Oh no. When I was 8, my dream was to live in Santa Fe. That's probably because I'm native though, right? Like I just felt like only real natives or like only, like if you're a real native, you lived in Santa Fe, right? And like not in this like, you know, rip off New York. Like,
oh man. That's kind of amazing to hear.
I painted my whole room to look like the Santa Fe colors, like the flag and everything, like all of the edge detail of my room, I like hand painted so it would look like all of the tile work in Santa Fe. You know, like I was like, someday I will live there.
Meanwhile, my friends and I were like, we got to get out of the land of entrapment. It sucks here. There's nothing to do except for like visit your cousins on the res. I'm so bored.
Yeah. But like McDonald's are so cute.
We do have green chili cheeseburgers at McDonald's.
I know. It's freaking adorable. Yeah.
It's true.
Yes. I feel like the best McDonald's in the country are definitely in Santa Fe. So, you know, you got that.
That's good to know because I became a vegetarian before I moved out of New Mexico. So I'm glad that my only experience with McDonald's was like pretty legit.
Yeah, exactly. It only went downhill. I don't think it's getting any better. No. You'd have to go to like Australia or something. They have very good McDonald's there.
Yeah, I did go to one in the south of France in Marseille. Ooh. Where they had like real like thick potato, like thick cut potato french fries.
Wow.
And they didn't call them french fries. but it was pretty amazing. I was really happy about that.
That's amazing.
Really after amazing. I got over how angry I was that we were going to McDonald's in France.
I mean, mostly it's like that I travel with my son a lot. And so that's why I've gone to like McDonald's around the world. Because my child is like, ooh. That and I'm like, okay, but it's like very fun to see how different they are all over the world.
I mean, that's a really good excuse though, like maybe. To have a child.
I mean, that's fair, amazing I was, like, to have a child. Yeah,
I was at the end of a bachelorette party kind of night, so that also kind of checks out, I suppose.
Oh, for sure.
We had like a very fancy French dinner before that.
I believe you. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a whole, like, scene in, you know, what's the movie? Pulp Fiction, right? Where they talk about going to France and then eating at a McDonald's. So it's made an impact in the world, you know.
That's true.
It's called culturally significant. Yeah, that's awesome. McDonald's in Santa Fe.
So maybe I forgot to say also that in my introduction, which always lasts like an hour every time I try to do one, that I'm an artist and an educator. That's not been completely obvious from the so far.
I mean, well, I just got sidetracked because it was like the child or teenager actress in a very beloved reality TV show, scripted reality. I don't even know what you
know.
Unscripted.
So the thing that was crazy about it, if I can continue on that tangent,
yes, I mean, please,
since it's been on my mind, was that we didn't have that word yet, reality TV. That wasn't like a thing. So what we said was, it's the real world, but at summer camp. Because that was like the only thing that we had to equate it to.
Yeah.
And people knew about it because we were the last season that aired, because our season turned out to be shot in New Mexico. So it wasn't like super goody two shoes kids like it was in other two camps. So we like broke the Disney Channel in many ways.
Amazing. Thank God someone had to.
Yeah. I'm kind of proud that I single-handedly brought down like the biggest show on the Disney Channel at the time. It's kind of, I don't know, that should be a point of pride, I suppose.
I mean, I'm proud of you.
Thank you. but I mean, it was a summer camp that I had gone to for, I think, four or five years. I was sent there at first when I was a little kid when my parents got divorced. And so for me, it was like this home space, and it was like really special. But then when the camp got selected to be on this show, they got really intense about like rules and like wanting to make sure that they were looking good. And, you know, a lot of the like things that we did normally at camp, and a lot of the leniency and freedom that we had, which is like, I think the best part of camp.
Yeah, that's like literally the point of camp.
The whole point of camp is to like be a little kid and pretend like you have freedom, except you don't, because there's always like adults everywhere constantly around you. But to like have enough self-agency to like make bad choices and stuff. Like that was a big part of what camp was. And, but they were just being really paranoid, and I got classically, as the t-shirt slogan goes, Eve was framed. I got like framed by my bunkmate who, you know, was like jealous that the cameras were on me all the time, because I was supposed to be the main character. And it was a really strange downfall, because I got kicked out of camp. And then like still, that's, for me personally, that was like horrible, because it was my home space, my safe space. Yeah. It was like the place that I loved more than anything else in the world. And I would never do anything to like jeopardize that. And then I got punished, and then in a really horrible, traumatic, terrible way that like, I think if it was now when they treated like a 13-year-old kid that way now, it would like not be okay. 20 years ago, they were like fine with that. and even like after the girl was like, I'm sorry, I lied, I like made it all up, it became like a really big deal, and I was really traumatized for like a year. And then I got over it and I felt like a little better. And then literally like right after I started to kind of come to terms with what had happened, it like aired on national television.
Right. So then it was like, everyone is like, oh my God, you're that right. bad person.
You're that bad kid.
God, that's, and yeah. It's so, there's so many, like, okay, first of all, this is amazing. Second of all, there are so many levels to the fact that it's like a real place as a child. Then that real place as a child becomes a fictional space where a thing that's hard to understand happens, but it really happens. It doesn't happen like in a story. You're not like, this director isn't like, cut, you did a great job, Eve, why don't you try crying a little louder this time? It's like, no, it's just real. We're just like really actually filming you being really sad because you're really sad. And then you get to watch the whole thing over again, like a paralyzed dream on TV. This is fucking crazy.
It's crazy, right? It's crazy. And yeah, I mean, it was a year later, because like obviously to be on brand, they're going to air it over the summer. So they like shoot it one summer and then they air it the summer after. And I was like a totally different human by then.
And like 13 to 14, you're like a totally different human, right? Like at that age, every year you're like, you grow exponentially.
Yeah. And it was like, then I was just trapped in like the most awkward summer ever. Between 8th and 9th grade.
Oh God, I am now terrified. Like, I feel like this is a nightmare that I didn't realize I had, but you have now awakened that in me. Now I realize what my deepest fear is.
Yeah, so, it's that. It's so much shit. And I wish I was, like, that good of an actor.
Right.
You know, they are really good editors, basically, because, like, a lot of it wasn't happened, but yeah. It was created in editing, not created in like them telling us how to act.
Right.
And actually the directors of the show tried really hard to make the camp not kick me out, because they were like, we picked her because she was going to be here all summer long, like for 8 weeks. It was going to be the one continuous storyline through like changing casts halfway through, because the kids were usually there for 4 weeks at a time. So like the big groups were going to change halfway through, and they didn't know how to deal with that. And I was like one of two people that were going to be there all summer.
Right.
And it turned out that the other dude was going to be just like my boyfriend.
Right.
So which was basically because we were the two people that were going to be there all summer. So we were like, we should make out.
Yeah. I mean, obviously. I've made out like, with people for less reason than that. So.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And especially like between 8th and 9th.
Yeah.
like choices. You don't need a lot more.
No,
other
not,
than
not that
round
much.
Each other. Let's you're make like, this happen.
You're like, I'm here. You're there. There you go.
Yeah. So, like, that they chose the two of us to be, like, their main kind of anchor characters throughout the whole thing before we even, like, got together. I'm sure that they were, like, glorified in their decision-making once we, like, started being boyfriend-girlfriend. But then they kicked me out, like, almost 4 weeks in. And the show was like, we have footage of, like, this other girl putting things in Eve's bag. And, like, we know that she didn't do it. And you need to not kick her out, like, for her own sake, but also for the show. And, like, please don't do it. And they were like, no. Like, she's gone. She's already gone. We don't care. You're not supposed to interact with camp activities. Like, you're just supposed to be here to document it. And then I saw the, like, producers a week or so later when they came to my house to interview me about what had happened. And they were like, we tried really hard to, like, save you and to, like, get you to be staying on at camp. But that didn't happen. We tried. I was like, wow, okay, thanks for trying. It was fascinating. But I also always credit that experience for my interest in, like, filmmaking and video, which is, like, basically my main medium of artistic work, because they let me, like, play with their cameras and their microphones and, like, gave me my own little camera to, like, record my own stuff with, and they didn't use any of it in the show because it was mostly just, like, the water in the river and, like, weird abstract things that, like, we're never going to use.
You never change. You've never changed it.
No, I haven't changed at all, basically. Just, like, I'm rainbow bright, and I still film weird things that not everybody's going to be into.
Well, that's great. So you became another person online, and then at some point you went to crazy art school, right? And film school. Why'd you do that?
Well, so this funny thing happened when I was growing up where I'm like a product of Indian Market. Or as a wonderful fellow artist once said, I was a booth baby.
Yeah. Oh, my baby's a booth baby. I'm a booth baby too. So. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a generational kind of thing, baby, and I could have gone in the direction of, like, going to the Institute of American Indian Arts, being near home, and, like, building what I envision in my other world would have been a pretty stable art career pretty easily, and I was, like, really into punk rock, and at that time wanted to be really smart, and as far as I knew, smart people went to college in Massachusetts
or
East Coast.
Sure.
I was like, I'm getting out of the land of entrapment, and I'm going to go to school on the East Coast, and I ended up going to Hampshire College and getting a very experimental, self-directed kind of education, which I think was, like, radical and definitely what I needed. And in as far as I know from, like, learning more about different processes of educational systems, a much more indigenous way of learning, where you're very self-directed, you're doing a lot of, like, I mean, I guess they would call it, like, the Socratic method of talking, being in conversation with your faculty member who's a, like, facilitator or mentor. But really, it just felt like I was learning from my elders and, like, figuring out my own path toward which people seemed like they had really good ideas that, like, I wanted to follow, which is, like, I don't know, it makes so much sense now, again, in 2020 hindsight, that I would be interested in that kind of learning system. I was also, or am still, continue to be forever, super dyslexic. So having, like, pretty intense learning disabilities when you're going through school and the under under school, I don't know, primary school kind of era is really tough because you're not able to like fit into the right box. And I had a lot of people like telling me all the time that I was dumb and like, I just didn't want to be that anymore. I like wanted to be really smart and be like, no, I got a fancy degree on the East Coast. And, like,
yeah.
I went where all the smart people are out East.
Yeah.
And so I did that in a way that was like going to be formative for my educational process. So I learned a lot there. I basically created my own degree in experimental film and photography. And then I did Native American and Jewish cultural comparison studies. As
Dude, that's amazing. I want to hear all your things. I want to hear all about it. That's amazing.
Let me turn on the light, now it's getting dark here.
Yeah, so. I know. I like turned on my light because I was starting to look like I'm in a witness protection program or something. Oh, you look so pink now. That's great. That's amazing. So what's the weirdest comparison you made in your research? I mean, because obviously I have my own personal ones where I'm like, oh my God. I mean, obviously they're both tribes, blah, blah, blah. But like, what is an even better one? Jewish and Native American. Boom.
I mean, the thing is that it's not weird at all.
Right. I mean, I agree. But yeah.
People are always like, oh, that must be so different. And oh, how do you like blend these cultures? And you don't know anything about these different cultures because you're like not Catholic or whatever. And for me, it was like, no. The more that I learn, the more it's exactly the same. And everybody's made this comparison before. And there's actually like zero differences. So I think that that's kind of maybe the weirdest thing, which you obviously like wouldn't see it as weird either, but you ask anybody who's not this specific combination of ancestries, they will be like, oh, that's crazy that they're really similar, beyond just genocide, I guess, which is
that's always the obvious one. And I'm like, mwah, mwah. Okay. I get it, guys. Genocide. Sure. But once I had someone from Israel who, you know, I think people don't realize, or maybe they do, I don't know. Anyway, it is a thing that I've noticed that people in other countries, when I say I'm Native American, they don't always know what that means, right? And so I have to kind of explain it to them, and sometimes to various effects. Like sometimes they have no idea that there were Native people in at all, right? Like that's happened to me with, I had a Polish professor who was like, it's weird that you say all this stuff about this like made up thing, kind of like as if I was saying I was like part Tyrannosaurus Rex or something, or not even like part unicorn, more like part, like a fake thing, right? Like a not, like a, like I was saying I was related to Thor or something, right? You know, like it wasn't like a mythological, he thought it was a mythological thing. And I was like, no, you know, there are really Native people here. And he's like, I mean, I'm sure thousands of years ago there were people at some point. And I'm like, oh my God. Anyways, point being, my friend from Israel was not like that, but she was like, she did ask me in this way. How do you know that A, you're a Native American and you know the sort of like cultural stories or like how are you considered Native American if you no longer have your country and it's no longer on your traditional land? And I said, interesting that you mentioned that because you're from Israel. And so I said, so what is it to be a Jew if you are not in the land that you came from, or you have a diaspora of many different nations? But how do you then know that? Are you really Polish? Are you really German? Are you really, how do you know that you're Jewish? She's like, oh, right. Because of the stories, because of the religion, because of the culture, because of the food, because of your mother, because, and I'm like, yeah, this is literally the same. This is the same.
Yeah,
it made sense, you know. But it's a fair question, right? Like, if you don't know, like, you're like, what is this Native America? Like, America is a different thing now. So, what is that?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Obviously, I think all of us Indigenous people who have spent a lot of time around people who have not spent time around Indigenous people, if that loop makes sense. Have experienced people being like, oh, but I thought you were extinct, like the dinosaurs, or like,
oh, yeah.
Like, Sarah was like part Cherokee, but that's because she's like old, you know. Right. Young people like now aren't that, and it's like, well,
right, or they're like, I want to be Native American too, and I was thinking of like converting, you know, like,
so. Right, yeah,
or the new version of that, which is that they got their DNA tested, right?
So right, yeah, exactly. It's it's a fascinating kind of thing when you think about that, like, mix of what it means to be Indigenous from somewhere. And I think that Jews do have a lot of that in, like, the embedded in the DNA of, like, what it means to be from a place. But yeah, also, like, embedded in that DNA is, like, what it means to be part of a diaspora, because, like, even in biblical times, we were, like, in Egypt, enslaved and like in diaspora, and like returning to the land. And that's why I always think it's so interesting that there's usually in contemporary terms more of a relationship with Indigenous people and Palestinians, who are also Indigenous to that land, you know, like there's a lot of people, basically most people are Indigenous to that specific part of the world. Makes it really complicated in so many ways. But I think, like, Palestinians are always like, oh, cool, we get it. Like, we get your struggle because we're living in occupied lands and we're, like, living under a settler colonial kind of governmental system, which, like, you know, I'm sorry to my Israeli family for saying so, because I have a lot of them, is definitely what Israel is, and what it was unfortunately created by. It doesn't have to be that way, but I have a lot to say about that. But it's not the purview of this podcast. But I think there's a lot of things that can be related in both of those struggles, and a lot of the feelings of, like, how do you, and especially as somebody who, like I am, like you are now, not living in our like ancestral lands.
Yeah.
Actually, my whole tribe, our reservation, isn't even our ancestral lands, because we're also
me either.
So we're like closer to where y'all were from, like not direct cousins, but probably back there somewhere. And thinking of like diaspora as being a huge part of both cultures is a really interesting thing for me to think about. So I think that's maybe like a really interesting, surprising thing that has been coming up more for me now. Of course, at first in undergrad, there was a lot of like Holocaust. There was a lot of thinking about humor in genocide. Those are the things that I was kind of focused on then. But right now, I'm really interested in thinking about different versions of diaspora and what it means to be Indigenous when you're not, like, even your Indigenous part isn't from where they're really from. And, like, where are we actually from? I don't know. who has allegiance to, like, a nation as a people, but, like, not allegiance to a specific geographic space necessarily, except for, like, in story. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about now in a bigger way between the two cultural perspectives.
When I first met you at the, we were both part of the first Native Lab at Sundance for virtual reality, which was very fun. And I think one of the first things that we got chatting about, among a lot of other things, but was, and I was really fascinated by the research you've done around urban natives in Los Angeles. And you just have done so much fascinating research about this. And my my grandmother was one of those you know, people that was encouraged to leave the reservation, to go through these work programs and to move to LA. And that's why my mom grew up like Gidget on the beach, you know, surfing with her friends instead of being on her reservation. It's all because of this stuff that Eve explained to me that I didn't even know about. And I was like, oh my God, that's the story of my family. And I didn't even know the sort of larger city planning federal organization around this. And that was really fascinating to me. And I really love the work that you're doing, kind of exploring that subject matter, and that it's the largest urban native population in the States, right? And I just think that's so cool. And it's this
center of culture and storytelling too. So it's I don't know, it's really kind of cool. I like that intersection of like LA is where our stories come from and it's where all our native people are in cities. I don't know, it's cool. But I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I just think you have so many fascinating things to say in that area.
Yeah, and like if you thought New Mexico was the place to be,
I was wrong. It was all those girls in the chat room were right for all the time. They were all native and they were all living in California. In LA on the beach. They were all named Eve.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that I thought was so interesting because of my grandparents being a part of the relocation program, and they could have picked Minneapolis, which is like way closer to North Dakota.
Right.
Connected to their family. And my grandma was like, Los Angeles is one of the cities, and that's like where movie stars are, and there's sunshine all the time, and like, why would I stay in the plains when I could go to LA?
I mean, yeah. That's amazing. I mean, my grandmother too, she wanted to be an actress, and my God, she was like gorgeous, but she was just ended up being like a waitress. But I see the photographs of her and I'm like, oh my God, she's just drop dead gorgeous movie star looking person. But yeah, I think she was like, oh, I can relocate and maybe be an actress. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, my grandmother was the same. She was the barn dance queen.
Mm.
So
yeah. Oh, long live the barn dance queens, man. Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting that when I was studying, Native American history in a real kind of collegiate academic way, where I was alone with a bunch of white people, to be honest, about the demographic makeup of all of the Native American studies classes that I was
in. Yeah.
Most smart people are. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about how terrible the relocation era was and how it was this horrific device of the termination program to fully assimilate Native American people, and that it was basically just as terrible and bad as boarding school. And I also come from a boarding school family. Like, my dad ended up going, and all of his siblings went to boarding school during a really weird, fascinating era toward the end of like missionary run boarding school, when suddenly when he was in high school, they transitioned into like teaching them beadwork and like how to dance, and suddenly like the tribe took it over and it was totally different.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy time also, because in some ways terrible, but in other ways also really beautiful, in a way that like our a lot of our artistic traditions were able to like care for those generations.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is just like super nuanced in how cultures tend to thrive and grow and change. And everything that I had heard was like the Relocation Act was meant to destroy culture, destroy language, tear apart communities. Like, it was really all this language of like rupture.
Yeah. And you said that it was orchestrated by the same person who created the Japanese internment camps in San Francisco, correct?
Well, he didn't come up with the idea.
He just executed it.
Like, we're not going to give him all the credit, right?
I mean, sure. I'm sure he was also an idiot. I mean, I think he was an idiot.
For sure. Like, that's what's so great. He was just this, like, guy who was, you know, had a bureaucratic job where he was like in charge of moving people around. Helped us to move people onto Japanese internment camps, and then after World War II and everybody like moved back, he was like, well, where do I go now? And the BIA was like, here you go, like, help us move all, like, you did a great job moving all these Japanese people out of cities into rural places, why don't you like do an even better job of moving all these Native American people out of rural places into cities.
So weird.
So it's like weird. Native camps, but opposite.
Right, right. They're like, strike that and reverse it. So weird.
I recently went, I was speaking at this conference in Los Angeles called the Four Freedoms Conference, and it took place at the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles. And so I got to go through a lot of their exhibits and all their kind of like immersive installations and everything, and learned, you know, even more about that, you know, as someone who grew up in the East Coast, I feel like I read everything in textbooks and didn't have a lot of really detailed information. And then living in San Francisco now and going to that Japanese American museum and just going through all the exhibits, you know, spending like 5 days there, you know, going through everything. I'm like, man, this is incredibly fascinating. And also this guy is why my grandmother is like so weird. So weird.
It's all so connected, and it's crazy that it was like some guy's assignment, and he just like moved from one assignment to another assignment because he was like good at figuring out how to move people around.
Yeah. Like, and not asking too many questions. Like,
yeah, and it's like that benign. Like,
right. Oh no, I mean, all of these things I think are right. Like, we systems, I think, you know, I talk, like, I give a lot of talks about like ethics in artificial intelligence and machine learning and these giant algorithms, right? You know, and how they can be black boxed and encode our bias and all these things. But really, we don't need black box machine learning algorithms. It can be as easy as a paperwork that is just like, well, that's the rule. You have to choose one of these three boxes, and then that box is going to decide which place you have to relocate to. Or, you know, I mean, they can be much simpler than a very complicated. We just need systems that are enough plausible deniability, right, to say that, like, it was just the way it had to be for a reason that is unknown. And, you know, mostly it just comes down to, like, fear and racism, but we have this nice process around it, you know, looking just a little bit of bureaucracy.
Right, like what Hannah Arendt's whole thesis on, like, the banality of cruelty is.
Yeah.
Paper pushers fulfilling somebody's, like, you know, wishes, and they're like, I don't know, it's just my job, man. Like, don't blame me for this thing.
Yeah.
It takes so much courage and bravery to stand up to that and be like, no, this is probably not okay. And hardly anybody's going to do that because they're like, I have to pay, you know, I have to, like, pay bills. And, like, this guy is like, you know, I had some other job, and then I got this assignment, and then because I did a good job on that other assignment, I got this other assignment. And it's just, like, the way that my career worked out, it felt like he was trying to, like, you know, tear apart cultures and imprison people.
Right, because honestly, if he had, it would have been, that's actually takes a lot of effort. Like, just following orders is, right. Like, default.
Right.
It's really the systems that allow these, like, of course that would happen in a system where certain lives are valued more than others. Of course, multiplicities of bureaucracy will allow that to continue to be the case, right?
Right. I'm moving locations so that
I like that. Nice.
Now I look like I'm in witness protection.
We're trading off, you know. That's a beautiful image.
Thanks. That's Chief Little Shell, my namesake.
Aww.
My uncle made that print.
Really? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, family of artists.
Yeah. That's awesome.
A little bit better. I was trying to sit under the light and get some more. Maybe a little bit more soundproof over here.
Little Shell's a great name. Yeah, I like it.
I wish I could, you know, claim any credit for coming up with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people always tell me, they're like, I like your name. I'm like, yeah, I didn't pick literally any part of it. So.
Yeah.
I was just born and really wish I wasn't, but that's okay. I'm just an angsty teen forever. So, but yeah, Little Shell, that's beautiful. Turtle and Bear Clan. You got all the, like, really good visuals. That's amazing. That's amazing. Oh, man. Yeah. Okay, so some people, I can talk barely, some people on my podcast have been talking about various, like, Native institutions and how if we just, you know, speculative futurism, sky's the limit, blue skies, kind of dream world, shenanigans, what would you imagine your version of Indian Market being like? If suddenly they're like, hey, Indian Market, it's yours now. You need to make it into whatever you see. You know, what would it be if you were the head of Indian Market?
Funny enough, I was on a committee.
Knew it.
To envision like the future of Indian Market and what it should be, and they took zero of my ideas.
Good. I'm all here for your ideas, so that's why you created them, so you could share them with us right now.
Exactly. And on the topic, before I dive into Indian Market, of Indigenous futurism, which is another thing I've been thinking a lot about lately. I always like to mention whenever I get a chance that Indigenous people of this side of the world have been living in a post-apocalyptic society for over 500 years, ever since contact. And I would actually say all of the world has been living in a post-apocalyptic society, because the world as we knew it, all of us, changed dramatically as soon as contact was made.
Yeah.
And, or more like, I should say, formal official contact that, like,
colonization, we can say. Yeah.
Like, as soon as that happened, the world as we knew it was over, and everything ended, and everything changed. So, technically, this is a post-apocalyptic society already, has been many times over. And it depends on what kind of futurism you're thinking of, but I always like to think that we're already living in an Indigenous futurism.
we already are living the, like, Terminator 3 or something.
So, anyway, when I think of, like, the micro of the focus of Indian Market, my whole reason for, like, leaving home and wanting to go get an arts education, because after undergrad, I moved to Los Angeles, and then after a few years, went to California Institute of the Arts, CalArts, which is, like, the hub of contemporary experimental artistic practices. Has been since the founding, a very kind of experimental, conceptually based place. And I very purposely wanted to go to a predominantly white institution, an institution that had a big reputation within the larger, like, contemporary art world. Because ever since I was a little kid, I was making stuff that was kind of like too weird and too different for Indian Market. And still showing in it every year and kind of being conflicted with, like, you know, my dad makes really traditional sculpture, most of my family does, I have cousins who are jewelers in amazing ways, people who make really traditional sort of art forms, and I chose photography as a medium when I was like 13, and from there even people are like, well, that's not a traditional medium, and I'm like, funny enough, there's been Native American photographers for, like, way longer than there have been Native American stone carvers, but whatever.
Yeah.
Sure. Tell me if I'm a weirdo.
Sure.
So I have always been interested in pushing the boundaries of different kinds of mediums. And in my dream of Indian Market, it would be focused on contemporary work, but in a way that was, like, aligned with the actual contemporary art world. So not necessarily only skateboards and hip hop, which is basically what they think of when they think of contemporary art. It's like, oh, cool, yeah, it's contemporary because we had, like, slam poets in a skateboard kind of meeting or whatever. Or like, oh, it's contemporary because somebody used, like, multiple mediums in this, like, traditional kind of way. But there's not really a place for truly contemporary work that is, like, beyond a traditional realm of just a booth. Like, there's no performance art. There's no, like, beyond kind of traditional dance and fashion and stuff like that. Like, there's not a place for you to do, like, installation work or new media work. Like, plug something in. Like, there's no place for that.
Yeah.
I think if, in my view, I would like only advertise in like Hyperallergic and Art Forum and like make it so that Indian Market is like, you know, the Venice Biennale of the Indian art world. Because that's what it should be, because that's kind of what it is.
Oh, it already, I mean, I would say it already is like economically, right? But it's more like so few, maybe, it's just a small subsector of the world that understands that, right? Like it has its diehard fans. It has an enormous economy, right? Which is incredible. I mean, bigger than a lot of art, like contemporary art fairs, actually, right? Like they make a lot more money. But yeah, but it doesn't have the kind of like press, or you don't have it flooded with stars. Like I remember the first time I showed at like this Scope art fair, which was like really weird art fair in New York that it like, but anyways, it was like the very first, I like get there, I'm at my booth. I'm a booth baby. I learned that from being in Indian Market. And so I'm there at my booth. And my booth, by the way, is I'm a performance artist. So my booth is just me being there in case someone walks by, I can like perform or something. That's not how performance art works. It was weird. They were like, just stand there. It's press night, Amelia. And I'm like, okay. So I'm like ready to do my performance, but I'm also like, this is beside the point because it's a durational piece. So it's supposed to just be, anyway, whatever. So the first person that comes by my booth is Brad Pitt. And I'm like, this didn't happen in Indian Market. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe he goes to Indian Market. But then he's like, oh, let me interrogate the message behind your postpartum approach to your blah, blah, like performance art. And yeah, it's true. It's like we get, the art fairs get a certain type of discourse, attention, clout, prestige. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and I mean, it basically already brings together so many people from so many different nations and basically like sends representatives of those nations to come together in one place and share their work with people. And yeah, it has all of the makings of like the Biennale or Art Basel or any of totally. Those, or like Documenta, any of those kinds of huge internationally acclaimed art markets. But it just doesn't get any of the clout of that outside of Indian country. Like if you get in, cool, that's great. But like you're only going to get in if you fit really specific parameters and you're doing work that's in a traditional way. And like I think there's a lot of things about Indian Market that are still holding on to the things that founded it 100 years ago, almost. I think this is like going to be the 99th Indian Market. So. Wow. Yeah, and like a lot of it is like it's keeping to its traditional guns, which I think like there is a place for that. Obviously, we're like,
oh, totally.
Have so much respect for our traditional art forms, and like a lot of us still do all of that. But there needs to be a place for like truly contemporary work to be showcased, and to yeah, get Brad Pitt to. Like,
he would come. I bet he would come. He's very nice.
Like in the 90s, I remember growing up, and like I had a horrifying experience where my mom forced me to go up to Arnold Schwarzenegger and like try to give him a necklace that my dad had made.
Dude, this is like something my mom absolutely would have done.
It's like horrible. I hated it. I was so upset. I was like, I don't want to go talk to him. He's terrifying.
I'm obviously.
Like, I don't know who that guy is. He's like super famous. I think it's weird to go up to him and give him something that's really expensive. Like, yeah, we could sell
it. Like, who is this guy? He's from Austria. But also, my mom loves Arnold Schwarzenegger, so she would have done the same thing. She'd been like, take that squash blossom, give it to him. My mom would have 100%.
Went up to him and, like, handed him this, like, cast silver necklace, which my dad was making these, like, tiny little mini sculptures, basically. And I was like, hi, Mr. Schwarzenegger. My dad is an artist, his booth is, you know, this number, and like, can you, like, here's this necklace, I'm this like cute little kid. And he like looked at it and was like, great, thanks, and like handed it to his little kid, who was like, oh, whatever, and like put it in their pocket, and they're like, bye, and like walked away. And I was like, yeah, that's why you don't give stuff away, like.
Yeah, well, and also, like, I'm sure he's like, whatever, oh my god, you know, like, right? I mean, that's, but at the same time, my mom would have done the same thing to me.
Yeah, but it was also before I knew anything about how celebrities get free shit all the time.
milk it. Yeah. Yeah.
And all the swag, and they're the only people that can afford to buy it. It's so much.
I know. But it's like, you want them to be brand ambassadors. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that's what, like, you know, my Jewish mother was trying to do.
Right, right. She's like, that's what I mean. Like, both my parents would have been like, yeah, they're very savvy people.
In the 90s, it was like that. But ever since, like, there's been a lot more restrictions, like, since the heyday of Indian Market, where there used to be, like, monumental sculpture
categories. Yeah.
So many interesting things that were happening back then, but, like, are now really regulated, and, like, you can't go 6 inches outside of your booth, and, like, all these, like, weird things that weren't really the case back when it was less regulated. And now they're regulated down to, like, the materials that you can use to be in certain categories. And,
oh my god, that's so intense. Yeah, that's, like, making me just, like, really, like, panic, and I'm not even, I have no desire to show. I mean, I love Indian Market, but I've realized from a very, like, young age, I never would have anything. My mom always hoped that I would create something that, you know, that she could sell at Indian Market. She tried for many years, from, like, the age of 11 to 15, to, like, something. You know? Like, here's the materials, don't use anyone's but that, and then, no, God, you know, like, I would always, you know, make it weird, too weird. But she tried. She really tried. And she was a jeweler, and, you know, did turquoise and silver and things like that. So she could kind of do stuff that would fit in better. But my stuff was right. Weird.
That's, like, not even her ancestral lineage.
No.
Of
oh my God, no. I mean, she knew that. She's like, I mean, look, my mom is very smart. Like, she was like, this is about money. Okay. Like, this is nothing. Like, we don't make silver jewelry. We're Haudenosaunee. Okay. We don't, like, we have silver that we, you know, like, saw. There's no turquoise. Like, you don't have turquoise. But, like, yeah, no. She couldn't even do the traditional sawing. Like, I could do that, because I have the, like, maniacal artist sensibility where I can do that. But no, she was just like, honey, you gotta work it, you know? Like, yeah.
And that's what I think is, like, the root of why Indian Market frustrates me so much, is, like, it's, which I guess is, it's about the market. Sure, it's about the market. Yeah. But honestly, in the last 10 or so years, nobody that I know has been making a bunch of money at Indian Market anymore.
Oh, that's too bad.
It used to be, like, this huge economic boost, and people would, like, make all their money for the year. And now it's honestly just, like, a horse and pony show, where we're all just, like, going out and showing our things, and people maybe buy some jewelry, but, like, they don't really buy big ticket items anymore, because the people who used to buy that stuff, like, filled up their houses in the 90s, and their kids don't care. And, like, it's a fascinating problem of the economics of, like, how Indian Market is going to continue. And I just think that they're losing so much support from contemporary young artists who are like, I grew up going to Indian Market. I grew up there every year. Like, I'm personally very conflicted, because this is the first year where I made a decision not to even apply. I was like, you know what? I've never, ever missed an Indian Market, ever. And it breaks my heart to think about missing one. But I was like, honestly, like, I have a show. Well, I have a show that's planned that's a person.
We all have things we will eventually leave our house for. Theoretically.
Eventually, when the pandemic is over.
You also have a university, quote unquote, that you work for. That someday you'll leave the house for.
Woo. Yes, I work for 2 art schools. mm-hmm. Cool. Those classes are going to happen again.
Yep, absolutely.
And in addition to that, I'm going to have a show in England, supposedly.
Nice.
We all open up for business again. That's supposed to be opening the first week of September. And I was just like, if I do Indian Market, I'm going to stress myself out, spend all my money to, like, go there, put on a show, not sell anything, just spend a bunch of money to do it, because it's expensive to do
Indian Market. Oh, yeah.
But, like, the booth fee is, like, nearly $1,000. Alone, which, if you don't sell anything, and then you have to take all this time off of work, and you have to travel there, and, like, all this stuff that's, like, adds up. And, like,
I'm at the point in my career where I'm like, it's not about the exposure at this point. Like, everybody knows my name or who I am and knows that I'm Bruce's daughter and whatever, but like, this isn't even the art world that I'm trying to be a part of.
Yeah.
And I think it's so sad that like the thing that I grew up doing and that I do really love, like, doesn't have a place for artists like you and I. Like,
yeah,
where are we supposed to sell, to like show our work or get support for our work? Like, and I know that we've talked in the past also about different art worlds and what that means, and like how Sundance has been able to find that place, like just to carve out support for Indigenous people that are doing weird new stuff.
Yeah, totally. I feel like they understand.
Get us, and that's kind of cool. Like,
yeah, I think it's cool.
Yeah, like I'm down. I'm glad that there's a place for that, you know, and yeah, that they're actively seeking new talent out, and they're actively like looking for new people and ways to support people. And you know, when I told friends and people that I know about like the specific like weird workshop that you and I met at, where it was like, oh, it's specifically for like Native American new media artists who are doing documentary based work.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what? Like,
<"You?" laughs> I was like, no, it turns out there's three of us. It's so cool.
I know. And all of you had done so, I mean, all of us had, were so different too. Like that was also cool. It wasn't even like we were doing the same kind of thing. Yeah. And we became a coven. We all decided we were a coven within like maybe a half hour. We were like, you're a coven, which is very important. Which is amazing. And the project that I did from that was the first time I ever got like those rankings they do in hyperallergic, and I never had gotten one of those. So you mentioned hyperallergic and I was like, wow, I used to like really dislike them when I was in grad school. I don't know why anymore. Just because you have so many opinions in grad school, right? Like you're just really like, I don't like this. I don't like that.
Well, I think that also comes from a place of not feeling like there's a place for you in those places.
Yeah. Like, yeah, totally.
Like I never saw a write-up when I was in grad school. Also like hated hyperallergic. I was like, I never saw like a place where they were talking about contemporary Indigenous art. And then I was like battling with Indian Market, which nobody at CalArts had ever heard of before. They were like, what's this weird thing? have is like one of the most formative moments of who you are as a person.
Never
even heard of it in this art world. And it was like, cool, hyperallergic is never gonna do a write-up. Indian Market is like,
yeah.
And at the same time, like hyperallergic didn't feel like it was going to talk about experimental Indigenous work, and then suddenly in the last couple of years it has,
right? So there you go, now I like them.
Wrote about something that I did too, so
oh good, yes, okay, good, yes, awesome, here we are. That's amazing.
I pay attention to us.
They're in trouble, but they get too many of us weird natives, and they're just, you know. yeah, well, and this year I got to go with Sundance to the Gathering of Nations, where we showed VR in one of the booths next to the pickle booth, and was on one side, and then the other side was scarves, which was very good. I definitely bought a bunch of scarves and a bunch of pickles. I bought both. But we showed VR that was made by natives as a Sundance booth. It was really, that was like, you know, this is, I want all of the markets to be like this. There's like, and then there's the Sundance booth where you can do weird VR stuff with, I don't know, really weirdos. It was great. It was great. Mostly our biggest fans were children and grandmas, as it should be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the demographics were like, if you win them both over, you know you did something right.
Oh yeah, it was like every photo I have of anyone in my VR piece was just a 8 to 10 year old or a grandmother, and I was just very very happy. I was like, this is right. It's like, it's because it's, they're the only ones not dancing, right? Like everyone else is competing for the dance, the dances and all that, and so like they're all just like, I'm bored, I'm gonna watch VR.
That's amazing. I think if I was in charge of the Indian art world, I would make Indian Market kind of like Gathering of Nations combined with Art Basel and yes, a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. Like
Oh no, I can't hear you. I've lost your mic for some reason.
No, what happened?
I don't know. I can hear you, but it's like you're very quiet.
Oh, that's so weird.
Now you're fine. Now you're good.
Great. There's some sort of like noise that happened in the background that I couldn't understand.
So weird.
So if I was in charge of the Indian art world, I would combine the Gathering of Nations with Art Basel, and it would be a bunch of money where you can just like visit with your cousins and show everybody your work and what you've been doing, and it's like a specifically indigenous space, and it's just like celebrating that, and yet everybody can still make a living.
Yes. Oh my God, I love this idea so much, especially because I did the art fair circuit for a minute in my art career, and it was so, the striking differences between Gathering of Nations and Indian Market is there's no children at any of these. There's no grandmothers, my two favorite demographics, just not even there. There's no cousins, okay, first of all, like no cousins at all. And no one is playing any kind of games of any kind, which is really sad. And the food totally sucks. You know, they might have like a champagne toast on the first day and some like, you know, rice crackers with some, you know, I don't know, fish eggs of kind and cheese and stuff. That's about it. There's like, there's no Indian tacos. There's no like, it's just, you're starving all the time. Let's be real. So yeah, I feel like, you know, it wasn't that exciting. I would much prefer your version where cousins, grandmothers, children, art and food, you know, obviously, and money. So,
right. I mean, that's like the only part of the Art Basel thing that I want to be injected into Gathering of Nations, Indian Market, magic world, is like somebody's support, like there's enough support out there from the mainstream art world to realize that there's like thousands of Native American, like also in my dream, I'll expand it in a moment, it's not just that it would be Native American, but like, because like Indian Market has really strict guidelines that you have to be, you know, enrolled in a tribe and have a CIB and like send your ID card image in and all of that stuff that, you know, doesn't allow for our cousins who are right across the border to participate. And I think that's not okay. Especially because like we both also come from borderlands people where like our tribes were cut apart by a totally arbitrary border that means nothing to our ancestry, but has completely changed like the way that we can move around in the world. And
yeah, totally.
I'm like often very sad that we're 5 miles south of the Canadian border. Like, yeah. I've applied to so many teaching positions and stuff that are like for First Nations and Métis people, and I'm like, cool, I'm a Métis person. You don't recognize me as such because my tribe happens to be 5 miles too far down. Like, yep. That's not.
Yep. I know, we got on the side of the country that doesn't have the grants.
Right, it's like so not fair. Not well, that it's all about money, but like, I don't want to have 3 jobs, you know? Like, I would love to just like have one teaching position and have that be enough and like not to have to be like racing around trying to do a 90-mile commute sometimes on Tuesdays, usually. Used to be. Not anymore.
But no, all of the commuting is just from the kitchen into the other room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. But yeah, I just think like there's so many things that are problematic about the way that these systems have been created over time that I would love to change.
I think teaching is just such an incredible, I mean, it's such a bounty to be able to do it. Like to have been a professor, to teach people, you gain so much. It's so valuable. I hear that the students like it too because they kind of keep in touch with you for the rest of your life. So I may theorize that it means something to them too. I definitely know from my, there are professors that profoundly impacted me in positive ways. and I will be like forever in their debt. I have like a massive debt that I got to pay off my whole life of mentoring other people to pay it forward. So it is, and it will always be the mystery of my life why our culture devalues teaching so much, when it like, having experienced both being taught and teaching, like, those are the best things in the world. Yeah, I don't know. It's so powerful. I always try to find whatever job I have to be a teacher. You know, I'm like, I know my job technically might not be to be a teacher, but I'm going to be a teacher. Always find like the teacheriest way of being that job. It's incredible.
I think that was like the craziest part for me of going to South Korea.
Oh my God. Yeah. They absolutely respect teachers. Incredibly.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Teachers.
Yeah. You're like a dignitary, right? Yeah, I know.
Doctors.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be. And I think, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, obviously we all have this shift and change that we're going through with this global realization that we're all the same species and susceptible to all the same things. And I think something that I'm hoping will come out of this is that people who have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to teach their children who aren't used to being teachers, I hope that it comes to a point where like teachers are then going to be respected in a much bigger way.
I like that. I hope that's true.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, I'm very hopeful right now. We'll see what happens. But right now I'm just like, oh my God, this like virus, which is horrible and like, you know, ravaging people's health, is also just revealing that our system can actually fix all the things that are broken. Like, we can house the homeless. We can provide health care. We can provide a universal basic income. We can take care of each other. We can kind of think about our elders before ourselves. We can educate our children. We can be together and be outside and like come together in a really interesting and new way and figure out ways of finding the importance of like connection. And that's only been like 10 days.
Yeah.
I'm like really thinking about it, and it's like, wow, we fixed all of the problems that were wrong with society.
Oh yeah. I thank you. I needed that. I will take all the positivity I can get. And it's not that I disagree. I'm honestly I feel like I'm on a roller coaster or something. Like some moments I'm just so tremendously hopeful and happy, and then other very, I mean, maybe not small things, but things that I normally wouldn't be so devastated by, I find myself just crying over, you know? And so I will take the positivity and try to hold on to it. Because yeah, sometimes I'm like, I don't know, someone at my work is leaving, and he was just a very kind person. And I mean, he's leaving, he wants to spend more time with his family. And so it's all positive, but I was just like totally crying about it just because I was like, I'm gonna miss him. And like, he was such a kind person. But yeah, I think if the circumstances had been different, I'd probably be like, oh great, good luck, have fun with your family, and like not have cried about it. You know? It's like, you know, things are just intense right now. Yeah.
Yeah, and it makes you like appreciate that connection to other people that you normally wouldn't feel in the same way.
Yeah.
So, like, the absence of them makes it so much more real.
Yeah. Yeah, no, really, it does. It's and I'm so lucky that I have been able to do this podcast to stay in contact with my friends. I feel like I'm also seeing a lot of my friends from New York more frequently because we're all like, hey, we're gonna do a virtual like happy hour, or we're gonna do a virtual like coding hackathon or whatever thing we're gonna do. And I see them, whereas normally I'm like, oh man, I really miss them. I haven't seen them in so long, and now I can see them all the time, which is amazing and weird and awesome. But yeah, I miss hanging out with people and saying stupid things and like making people laugh. So I don't know, I try to do it on Slack. I'm just not as funny on Slack, so
yeah. I mean, I take classes with yoga teachers that I love in other parts of the country who I normally can like maybe do a yoga class once or twice a year with them,
And now I'm like, cool, I'll like see you on Tuesday. That's awesome.
That's awesome. That is, man, okay, I'm going to start doing that. I like bought the Switch game for yoga because I was just like, I'm going to start doing yoga on the Switch because I'm ridiculous. But I should do that. That's more normal.
Well, there's all these yoga teachers who, because like I travel a lot for my job. And yeah. I've somehow felt like really connected to a lot of cities and communities all over the world now. And because of that, like, because when you travel for work, you have to like do really normal things in different places because you're like not on vacation.
Like, no, exactly. And it's like, it is your life. So you can't pretend like it's a, oh, I'll just like eat out and eat trash for this week. Cause you're going to be doing that every week. Always. I'm the same way. I travel so much for, used to have had travels, but I had like, I don't know, 8 flights planned in the next 4 weeks. And so it's like, now I'm just home. But yeah, you have to kind of make it normal. You have to make your normal on the road, right?
Yeah. So like I started, you know, like I think Instagram is a great way to keep in touch with people, like as a photographer, to know what people
yeah.
And so like I follow all these like yoga teachers and stuff on Instagram who I like take classes with in New Orleans and in Santa Fe and even and I'm like, wow, I can now like create a yoga schedule that includes all the people that I love learning from all over the place, except I can do it all like from home in a week, which is not the same thing at all. But like, I can hear their voices and like practice in their space, which is so amazing. And yeah, I don't know. I personally have just been in like a state of like joy from being home and like being freed of my commute and my routine and like the parts of the daily life that stress me out. And now I'm just like, cool, I can like do my job in a relaxed way where like if I need to rest, I can get up and rest, and like if I need to go stretch, I can go do that. If I need to like call somebody, I can make time for that now. Like it just feels really different. And I'm also really excited about the world, like literally just Earth healing herself in a really interesting way. And like I was telling a friend earlier today, apparently this like blew her mind, so I'm gonna say it here too. That like I was noticing there's a lot more clouds in Los Angeles than there normally are, and I started researching like what's up with all these clouds, you know. It's like I know it's been raining a lot, but there's a lot of just like big white fluffy beautiful clouds that we don't usually have here. And, you know, when you grow up in New Mexico, you're very used to like looking at the sky all the time. Yeah. And that's not something that people in LA do ever. Because the sky is usually pretty boring here. There's not like a lot that's going on. And I started looking into it, and apparently like the building of clouds can be like vastly hindered by certain kinds of pollution, like particles. Wow. So there's like very preliminary studies. It's not like a lot of things that people have studied, I guess, but with like certain findings, they're like realizing that like the formulation of rain clouds and like certain kinds of like just white puffy clouds get hindered by pollution particles, and clouds can't form in the same way when it's like super polluted air. And so I'm like, oh my God, like in this last week where there's like less traffic, suddenly there's more clouds, and that's like awesome.
That's amazing. Wow. That's incredible. I've noticed really incredible white fluffy clouds here in Oakland as well. And I wonder if it's a similar reason. Yeah. I just keep saying it to my boyfriend. I'm like, look at that one. It's adorable. And he's like, yes, yes, that one's adorable. As well as the last 10 ones were in fact adorable. Yes.
Yeah, but it's like different. It's like significant, you know, to be like, wow, suddenly there's like cool little wispy clouds, which like are normal in most places, but not in these like big heavily polluted cities. So that's like,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Eve's just doing yoga, looking at fluffy clouds, being a teacher. Oh my God. You're like a whole medicine woman right now.
Work at night.
Yeah.
Making all kinds of earrings. I mean, but also the teaching part is the most stressful part, I will say. I've been procrastinating probably worse than my students have been in figuring out how to move remote with my classes.
Yeah.
Much well, of my practice is just like being together and being in a space and holding space for the students to like talk about whatever it is that they want to talk about, whether it like has anything to do with the class or not. So it's really complicated to figure out how to like hold that space when I don't care at all about assignments or grades or anything like that. I'm like, my class is about being together. So like, I don't know what to do. That's scary. This is my
week. Scary. And I know before we decided to do this podcast, I thought maybe you should talk about why it's so important to have presence for art classes. Because I don't, you know, not everyone went to art school. Even people who are in film or in the arts, not everyone went to a traditional art school. Especially, you know, CalArts has like a very specific, legendary way of teaching that is so hands-on and so about time. I mean, everyone at CalArts will talk about, yeah, I had a 16-hour crit once, or, you know, right? Like, you guys are, like, famous for this craziness. So I want you to talk about it, because not everyone's experienced that.
Yeah, critique is, like, that's the main thing that you do there. I mean, and it's so funny. I was in a Zoom faculty meeting yesterday, and there's somebody else who's teaching at Otis, who I graduated from CalArts with in the same year. And they were like, I don't know what to do because so much of my class is about critique and like nothing else really matters in my class. And I don't know how to have an asynchronous class because I don't care at all about the lectures that I'm giving. I only care about like providing a space for critique. And I was like, me too.
Yeah, that's real.
Yeah, that's because we like sat together in like 6-hour long critique classes.
Yeah,
I think like those things can be really traumatic and horrible, but they can also be really beautiful and amazing. And I think just holding space for like different kinds of perspectives and thought on art, and just like the luxury of being able to spend 4 or 6 hours talking about work, or getting a captive audience of like 15 to 20 people to just talk about your art for like up to 3 hours can be, I mean, there's like no other time in life that you're gonna get it.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And I went to like a traditional MFA program, and yeah, it's like the most angry I've ever been in my life has been in a crit. The most sad I've ever been has been in a crit. The most happy and the most like triumphant, like all those like things. Even now, and especially it's that moment when you actually learn how to own the space, right? Which it takes everybody different amount of time, a different impetus, a different reason why they get there. But everyone gets there. Everyone gets to a point where they can own that space.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
Just like acknowledging that you're an artist is huge. Like when I think it was like the first real lesson that I learned at CalArts was like, oh, my artistic practice includes education and being an educator. And like, that's part of what I do. And to be able to say that, because I was so embarrassed that everybody else had like these, you know, BFA degrees. And I was like, well, I don't know, I went to like a nerdy theory school and like,
yeah,
read a lot about genocide. And
like, have you heard of the Jews?
There were several. And I was like, you know, I know how to write a lot of really long, intense theory papers, but like the idea of referencing artists when I'm talking about somebody else's work is like really scary. And it was a totally different perspective. I was like, I grew up as an artist. I've always been an artist. There's never been a point in my life where I was ever thinking that that was not what I was doing. But like to really acknowledge that like everything that you do is part of your artistic practice, which I think is what art school is kind of for. It's just like training you in how to like hold that kind of space and know that that's what your perspective really matters, because you're a creative being and like a way of being.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I will say CalArts does not teach you as much about how to make the stuff that you're trying to and that is really different. Especially now that I'm teaching at Otis, which is like a more traditional art school that is really technique. And the way that I'm teaching my students is like, I don't care if you learn how to use this camera or not. I'm more interested in like how you're going to relate this into the rest of your artistic practice. And all my students are like, I don't understand how to read this really deep theory paper, like
reading assignment that you're giving me. I don't know how to talk about these weird films that you're showing me. I don't know what to say. And then their comments are like, that's a lot. Like, cool, good neighbor. And it's really interesting where they're just like really focused on the technical aspects of things. I'm like, the technology doesn't matter. Like, technology is going to change tomorrow. And like, whatever you're using with it is what really matters. Like, the ideas that you're going at it with. And that's, I think, the thing that CalArts taught me the most.
Yeah. And you hope that it, like, you hear what all of these people in your critique group say about your work, and you get to vehemently deny all of it, and then later be like, oh, maybe that was kind of true, right? But most importantly, I think it taught me then to look at my own work and be able to see when it's bad, like read my own receipts and say, like, okay, yeah, I can tell when I'm making work that is good for me, right? Even if, and then that's kind of that, I felt like that was the point when I owned the room, is when people could say, oh, well, it's not good because this is, and I'm like, well, you don't understand it, like, this is what I'm trying to do, and this is why this piece is good. And that's really what you're working towards, right? Is like, you yourself knowing hopefully what you're doing, and then how you can tell when you're doing it.
Or even different levels of knowledge and being able to know what those things are. Like, I feel like art school prepped me for being able to have a lot of different kinds of conversation about the levels of what people were allowed to know in my work, which, like, yeah, as artists is really important. And I think, like, that was great training ground in learning how to deal with, like, criticisms that will come up from people that have no idea where you're coming from culturally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there was a moment that happened where you had to stand up for us during a conversation of, like, you know, a great person who was trying to get us to be vulnerable and maybe trying to get us to open up. And, like, none of us wanted to open up because it was like, that's not part of our tradition. Like, these specific things that we're talking about can't be on the conversation table. And I think you did a great job of standing up and being like, you know, there's different levels of, like, what we can explain as Indigenous artists and what we can't, and, like, why we're going to do something and why we're not. Like,
yeah. And we're not going to explain it to outsiders because it makes sense to us. No, that's okay.
Even if it doesn't, it's like, oh, that's, like, culturally specific, but I know not to ask about that because that's not my culture. And I think, like, that was really shocking in art school when people, like, wouldn't understand what I was doing and wanted me to, over-explain it. And then I resisted against it. And instead started making work that was like, oh, you think I should be this way? Okay, well, let me make a piece that's, like, about me getting into this bubble that you think, and then, like, breaking it.
Yeah.
Which I think is, like, where all of my work has come from since then.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of us Native artists have had that experience in art school, and I always ask other Native artists to show me their work in school, and it's always the same. It's like all these, like, great tropes and, you know, like, dime store novels and pulpiness, and I love it. I, like, love that. That's like, we have to go through the performance of Native in everyday life as seen by, like, a 1950s, you know, Western or something. We have to, like, move through it so that we can, like, you know, I don't know, find our own sassiness.
Right. Like, I did this I did this collaboration with one of my best friends who I met in grad school, and he was doing really similar work to me, but from, like, a totally different cultural perspective. Being that mine was from a cultural perspective and hers was, like, not. Hers was, like, environmentalism in a totally different way. But our processes were really similar, and we decided that we would do these, like, performative light painting images together about, like, for me, it was, like, about invasive plant species. For her, it was about, like, the destruction of that these invasive species were doing on the land. And we would show the same piece, like, the same video, photo, performative piece to the same faculty members at different times, like, individually in studio visits and critiques. And she would get a whole bunch of feedback about how it was, like, referring to the sublime and, you know, traditional, like, English painting, and how she was invoking all of these, like, manicured garden landscapes, and mine was all like, oh, it's about how you're really connected to the land. It was like, we're doing the same work. And then afterwards we would share notes with each other, and she was like horrified because she's so sweet, and she was just like, I'm so sorry, I had no idea that people were gonna like critique you in a different way than me. And I was like, oh honey, that's like part of the experiment for me. That's like,
she was like, I baked that in. That was definitely part of my plan. Like,
I don't know why. You have to tell me what happened. And it's so funny because she still feels bad about it now. She's like, oh my god, I feel so bad I like that happened, and I still don't know how to deal with it. And I'm like, no, I think that's exactly what it's about. It's about thinking about different ways that like the same exact piece of art can be seen by the same exact person in totally different ways based on who's making it.
Totally. I mean, that always has been, right, with art. Like, it, you know, I'm sure we now look at things in museums that we don't know who the artist is in a Byzantine era or something. But up until, like, you know, anything postmodern, it's very much about the personality. It's, you know, who is making it and why. And, you know, I have lots of different feelings about identity politics and art, mostly because they weren't very interesting to me in my experience. I'm really glad that there are so many Native artists that I get to connect to, and I do wish I had even more of them in art school. I was very sad in art school until two Native people joined like 2 years under me. So I was at school for 2 years very miserable until like the last year two Native people joined, and man, it was smooth sailing from that day. I just was so happy.
Yeah, in my last year, there was a first-year student who was an Indigenous woman. She was making really interesting work. And then on graduation day, I, like, danced in a shawl across the stage.
Amazing.
I saw this amazing other person who was, like, also shawl dancing across the stage to get her diploma, and I was like, who is this person? Why didn't we know each other? Oh my god, this is such a tragedy. She was there and I didn't know her. And that turned out to be Suzanne Kite.
Oh,
is amazing and a badass. And like, we ended up having to find each other, and I think we ended up finding each other like that night. We were like, oh my god, I have to find that other shawl dancer.
That's amazing.
And we ended up finding each other, and now we, like, you know, just spoke on a panel together weeks ago, and the relationship really continued. And I'm just like heartbroken that we couldn't have like collaborated in school. It would have been so good to have her as a resource back then, but at least we found each other somehow.
oh yeah well, that's amazing. I went to undergrad and at George Mason University. I have like so many degrees. I'm one of those weird collectors of degree. I'm just like addicted to school. But one of my undergraduate degrees was from George Mason, and they allowed us to take any elective we wanted that we could get into at Howard. And of course, Howard is a historically Black university. For those people who may not know, I don't know how anyone wouldn't know that, but Howard's amazing. And right? But it was an incredible experience. And I just remember going to those classes and being like, oh my God, how I wish there was a Native university like this. So fancy. And so, just the, you know, oh, Spike Lee is speaking, you know, this week, and Maya Angelou is speaking next week. And like, you know, just incredible speakers, the rigorous, amazing. And the students are so well-spoken and talented and just, you know, really exceptional. And so the discourse you have in the classes is so incredible. And so I was like, oh man, I wish I had had that, but like in my MFA. So, you know, I don't know, I could still dream. And I met a friend in LA recently who also went to a historically Black college, and he's like, do they have that for Natives? I'm like, we have a couple, we definitely do. It's not like Howard, but you know, not quite the same.
At Dartmouth, if that wasn't like totally colonized too. Oh,
God, I know, we did indeed.
For us, it should have been ours. That should have been
the
thing. And now it's like
the same, like, measly maybe 0.2% Native American population as every other school.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like to imagine that you'd be like the, I don't know what class, you'd be teaching experimental filmmaking at the Native Power, and, you know, and a class about, like, futurism and the diaspora.
Yeah. My dreams.
Yeah.
It's, like, all I want. I mean, maybe in the future, if we're thinking of Indigenous futures, I could eventually be like that someday, but I'm not sure that it's, it was like that maybe, like, when it first started in the 60s, it was almost, like, already that, and then it kind of, I don't know, changed. It's not exactly that now, but it's close, I guess.
yeah, totally.
In the future. Ugh, I would love to teach that class.
Yeah. I would obviously, I don't know, I would definitely teach a class on, like, Native trolling online or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the class, my favorite class I taught at Vanderbilt was viral performance and the internet. And it was just getting things that weren't real to become real on the internet. Like, we would make these huge media campaigns saying that there was a real life Sims game that you could play. And then people would get all on board with it and, like, all signed up for it. And then they'd find out that it was just all of the IP web cameras all over the university. And there'd be students at each one of these locations. And then it was, like, press a button and it would, like, flash a light in real life. And then that person would give a donut to a random stranger and be like, hey, can you jump up and down and just take this donut? And they're like, sure. So then it would seem like you're controlling all the students all over campus.
That's amazing.
I don't know. We made really crazy stuff. But it was very, it was all, like, these, like, things that weren't real, but making them real through the internet. And it was kind of at a time when they didn't have, like, sort of the concept of things going viral was just starting to be written about or whatnot. It's very fun.
I wonder if that term is even gonna continue now. I don't think so.
No, because it's like, God, I don't want to catch anything.
Well, like, that actually means, like, oh,
I know. Well, and also the internet, I mean, we've already seen, like, that was a very innocent time in the, like, it was around 2008. That was, like, a really, or, like, yeah, like, it was a very optimistic time in the internet where people are like, flash mobs, they're so funny, you know, like, it was 100 people just doing the Macarena in Times Square, you know, this all seemed, like, very cute and quaint and, yeah, I think that stopped, definitely.
Yeah, I was like, oh, social media is like Twitter was built to save the world. Like, it started revolutions and it's going to free people. And, like, yeah, so, like, we're all different now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was talking today, actually, to my program officer, Kat, from MIT. And she said, you would not believe this, Amelia. Facebook is like a warm hug right now. Because of this crisis, it's just like an outpouring of love. Like, and it's true, I haven't been on Facebook in a really long time, but I, like, after she said that, I started checking it out. It is, everyone's being so nice. It's, like, totally different. It's super changed. People are having a love fest on there right now, just, like, cheering each other up, warm hugs, good wishes, fluffy white clouds, you know.
Extra clouds.
Who would have thought? Because, like, in 2016 we were like, you definitely killed democracy, and then right now we're like hugging each other on Facebook. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've only kept up with Facebook because it's, like, the only way that I can keep up with all my family on the res.
Totally.
There's so many of them, and I feel like they use Facebook in such a different way than I do, which is, like, I just basically avoid it. And don't really interact in any significant way. And they, like, you know, ask each other over for dinner, or, like, see who's, like, kid is, you know, hanging around where. Like, where did my kid end up tonight? Like, anybody have them?
Normal stuff. Well,
yeah, and it makes me feel like I'm part of that, because, like, yeah. Most of it is just, like, my res family. And I'm like, cool, like, I feel like I'm very well aware of what everyone is doing, and there's no other way in the world that I would possibly be able to keep in touch with, like, all 60 something of my cousins and, like, all of their kids, and, like, know what's going on with anybody.
So Facebook for me has always been, has been that for many years, which, you know, I just kind of scroll past all of the vitriol. But it's also probably why I'm not actually on Twitter, because Twitter seems like the scariest part of all of that.
I am very afraid of Twitter. I've like done a little bit of Twitter. My partner is very good at Twitter because he's very witty with words. He's a writer. And so I feel like Twitter is like, makes sense. That's, you know, his expression is words and Twitter is a rhetorical structure. But I always step into it. I will never say the right thing. I'll always start some kind of war that I didn't even know. You know, it's like, I feel like I'm walking through the kitchen and knocking over like a bottle. And then now I'm at war with, you know, the next door neighbors or something. I don't know. It's totally crazy. But I'm trying. I'm trying to get better. I'm doing a takeover of a Tig Notaro has having native comedians take over her Twitter this whole month. So I'm going to do one of those takeovers, but I'm not allowed to say what day, but one of the days is going to be me. So I'm going to try, but I have to be like, boyfriend, what is a Twitter takeover? He's like, oh my God, there's never been a good Twitter takeover. I'm like, oh no. I don't know.
Tig is such a hero. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, Joey set it up. Joey Clift, who was previously on Wampum.codes, he's in charge of, you know, he kind of reached out to her and said, wouldn't it be cool if like natives were featured, if we're comedians? And she's like, yeah, totally. So that's awesome. Yeah, it's totally him. He's a very good organizer.
Yeah, I just think like, I mean, the luxury in another way of that is there's enough social media networks now that like you can pick and choose whichever one like makes the most sense for you. Like I am pretty solidly into Instagram being a visual artist because like I don't like Twitter because I don't like to just shout into the void and I like don't know what to say. And the conversation lines make no sense and like the visual layout is confusing. I like that on Instagram I can just like post pictures and videos and that's like all I care about making anyway, so it's fine. I don't care if anyone is into it or not. It's nice as like a daily practice to always like make something new and to frame something and like try to take a picture every day in a good way, in a creative way. And Twitter is weird. I don't know. Facebook is weird because I also, you know, went to college in Massachusetts and was a first year, the same year that Facebook was created. And the only way that you could be on Facebook then was if you went out to Massachusetts. And you had like a EDU email address from like a really specific select amount of schools in Massachusetts. And that's like how I started on Facebook, was being like one of the first, I don't know, 1,000-ish people on there probably. Which is terrifying to think of. But it just seemed like, I don't know, it's weird to like watch it grow into whatever it is that it's grown into. But yeah, I like that there's social media that you can like pick and choose which one you're into and which one you're not into and it doesn't like matter.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I was trying to explain what Instagram is to my boyfriend. I mean, he obviously knows what it is, but he's like, why isn't it just like Insta thoughts and influencers like with water bottles and exercising? And I'm like, I don't know.
Only if you
like it, to be honest. Yeah, because it's like everyone I follow is an artist and it's like all artists are into Instagram, right? Because it's like, they're like, look, this is me in my studio. These are me with my new fabrics. Look at my new paints.
Right.
You know, like it's just like, that's literally, it's all my feed is just artists like doing artist nerd shit and that's it, you know? So I'm
like, look at these cool things that my artist friends are doing. And look at this funny thing that like my artist friend found somewhere else on the internet and then posted here so that I could see it and didn't have to deal with Twitter to find it. Like,
yeah, I love it. I mean, I'm very curious. Now I want to follow these Insta hotties. Clearly I'm like, what? I'm missing out on a huge part of this platform. I don't know. I want to have Instagram influencers in my feed. I'm like, what is this? I mean, I do follow Britney Spears because her Instagram is the best. She quotes Nietzsche. It's great. But that's probably the only, maybe influencer that I wouldn't even call her an influencer though. She's Britney, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I have a few friends that are influencers, but they're influencers from like, because they're fashion people and they're like just my legit friends, which is kind of amazing. To like watch their careers blossom through it. And then I think that's my only like insight into what the Instagram influencer world is. Cause they're like, hey guys, I'm doing a poll of such and such thing. And like 100,000 of my million something followers like bought this. And, wow. That's crazy that my friend from high school is so.
That's so amazing and weird. Yeah.
But yeah. I like that you can really curate who it is and it's not like, it doesn't seem like as much of a social issue if you're like not following somebody or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Friend someone on Facebook, that seems so harsh.
It's so true. It's so true.
Not my friend anymore and unfriend you. That's like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that you have to like, you know, like give them permission to friend you or these kind of, I don't know. Yeah. It's weird.
I also like thinking of Facebook as like where my family lives and then Instagram is where all like my weird art people are.
Yes, that's how I feel. And then Twitter's where my son and my boyfriend live and that's Boyland. That's fine. And LinkedIn is where I have to have my office headshot. Right.
Yeah. LinkedIn is that thing that I didn't sign up for and somehow I'm on it anyway.
Oh my God. That's so true. That does happen. Yeah.
Yeah, and Instagram is like where you get flyers for shows now that flyers are digital.
Yes, it's also true. That's how I know where to hang out with people when I used to be able to do that.
We used to hang out at IRL.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. Not that, I don't know. This pause I think will be too brief. It'll feel long in the moment, but then it'll like, once we get back into it, it'll be like, oh man, remember when we could just like hang out with our friends online and like had time to talk to each other?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I do feel like work will change a little bit. Like I hope more companies are okay with working from home and understand that it can be a very valuable thing. I used to only do it at my work, one, maybe 2 days a week max so that I could get work done because like I just could write or code. I cannot do it in the office. It's like, even though everyone's very nice, it's just so distracting. Or even if someone just taps you on the shoulder for 1 second, they're like, hey, I have a question. Is the food come? And I'm like, oh my God, now I have no idea what I'm coding. I'm like, my whole hour's ruined, you know? So I have to like do it at home. So, but yeah, it is, maybe more companies will feel comfortable doing it. Cause I do think it can help, especially for like teachers that have to have so many jobs and commuting and, for people like me who need like some space to like do heads down coding or whatnot, like it can be valuable.
Even not just like coding, like I get so much more work done when I'm not at work. I love my coworkers, but we're like gossipy bitches.
Like, yes.
That's all we do all day long is just like talk about what's going on and spread rumors and like don't do any actual work. And like the only time that I get things done is like when I'm just alone at home and I can just like buckle down, get everything done in like a couple of hours. And then I'm like, cool. Now I'm like free to do something different, which when I go to work, I spend like hours being stressed out and angry. And I drive 60 miles just to like go, you know, be angry and stressed out and then like drive back home. And then I haven't done anything all day. So it's like,
yeah,
I think there's so many people that are probably in the same boat and I hope it changes. I hope that people like realize that healthcare is important and that childcare is important and that like flexible workspace is possible so that we can like take care of each other. And I hope that like the politicians in the world wake up and realize that like society can't keep living paycheck to paycheck and people need to be flexible. And that if something like this happens, like we need to be able to like take care of each other and not be so worried about like making money. And even that the stock market doesn't have to grow all the time, like grow. It just like, sometimes it's okay if like you shut it down for a minute just to like rest. I wish they would just shut it down. Like they shut it down for Christmas. Why can't they just shut it down right now? Like just,
I know. I mean, it would have probably been better for all of our stuff. Like,
just like, let it sit there for a minute. It doesn't have to, you don't have to make any moves. Just like everybody shut it down and like, we'll get back to trading and like making profit or whatever eventually. But like right now we need to just like take care of each other. I still don't understand why they didn't just like stop it, but
I mean they froze some of it, but
you know. Yeah, but it's like cut it down.
Yeah.
Like, don't trade on the weekends. Just pretend like it's a really long weekend.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'm also not a stock broker. I know nothing about it. It just to me seems like, you know, structure institutionalized gambling. So I don't know. it's like companies don't need to do big stock buybacks. You don't need to continually make profit. Like you need to take care of your employees first.
Yeah.
What's the point of being a job creator if you're like going to screw people over by those having like inflexible jobs?
Yeah.
So I just hope that it wakes everybody up to a more sustainable future and that teachers suddenly start getting paid like way more than stockbrokers.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. They could get, you know, their own kind of dividends.
Crazy. Anyway.
So what are you working on these days of your own projects? Either I saw you beating some skulls. That's amazing. I love that. I love your beadwork. It's awesome. In addition to your beads, what else are you up to?
At the moment, I'm trying to pivot my experimental analog Super 8 filmmaking class to the digital realm. Even though my main promise for my students was that they were not going to be working today, things change. So I'm pulling out all of these like weird esoteric handmade film techniques that I happen to know, which is kind of amazing and feels good to have gone through a lot of trainings that are focused in analog film techniques. Making your own developer, making cameraless films, making like pinhole films out of boxes and tape, being really scrappy with it. So I'm trying to figure out ways to teach my students that and make them like happy and feel okay in that way. But also just like holding space for them because they're freaked out. Like most of them got kicked out of their housing when the campus closed. They're freaking out, like they're going back to home situations that aren't always like safe and healthy. And, you know, I don't have like formal training in how to deal with people's mental health other than being like, cool, I have a crazy family too. I told you about it. Like, I'm here to like listen to you if you need like somebody who's been through weird stuff to like talk to you before. Most of my time is like during the day is being spent helping people cope with the crisis at hand, which I selfishly feel so happy about being at home. And I need to get to work on this project that I've been supposedly working on for years about migration and relocation. I finally got my boyfriend to be learning Unity. So he's a technology person. I was like, John, Amelia said that if you know PD, you can make my virtual reality stuff. So
totally. That's awesome. Yes.
Call me back. So he's like taking a Unity course, which is awesome. We're planning a wedding, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Apparently planning a wedding in 2020. Who knew? There's a lot of that stuff going on that makes it hard to be focused on bigger projects other than just like beadwork at night, which is kind of my respite.
I've been sewing pouches and bags.
That's amazing.
That's like my dumb craft that just keeps my hands moving and my heart okay.
Sorry to have those things though. Just like keep you meditative and focused. Something small.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I'm excited about this big project, this big virtual reality migration project, which I need to get off the ground. I've been talking about it for years, and now it's like I have a really solid actual plan, and I just need to like get the technology in place to be able to do it, which isn't all that complicated. It's mostly just like I have to sit down and do it, which is hard when you have
you know, three other jobs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's hard. It's hard anyways. Getting started in a new software is difficult. I do know the developer evangelist for Unity. If you or your boyfriend get stuck and would like to kind of chat, he has a lot of great resources, both like online tutorials, but also just can kind of walk through your code sometimes too and be like, you're stuck or something's weird is happening.
That would be amazing.
I'll introduce you guys. I've done that for a couple. I used to be part of this. My really dear friend Sue Noh started this women's Unity group in New York, which was really funny because everyone thought we were like a church or something. Because I'm like,
sounds really beautiful.
And they're like, wow, what do you guys do there? I'm like, we drink wine, eat pizza, and learn Unity tutorials. And they're like, wait, what is a Unity tutorial?
Oh, I thought this was like a feminist processing group.
No, we're like, I mean, we're just like, we're computer nerds. But we all also are processing and feminists, but just also computer nerds. I really hope that the Unity group goes virtual so that I can invite you and like all my other friends, because I feel like I miss it. I miss it. That's like one of the things I miss the most about New York is my women's Unity group. So I really selfishly want it to go virtual, but also like I hope maybe a couple other expand the coven a little.
Yeah, see, isn't that the best part of this whole thing? It's like, oh, our social circles don't have to be revolving around the people that are near us.
Yeah. No, it's amazing.
All the people that we love.
Yeah. I'm so into this. It's almost like we're rediscovering the internet. Because, like, we do that when we were first kids because we find these people far away from us. Like, I mean, I used to have so many internet boyfriends. Oh, my God. When I was, like, 13, you know, I'm just coming up with you. You're the only one that understands me. You live so far away. But now I feel like we're rediscovering, like, oh, yeah. I don't want another internet boyfriend.
Well, it's because all of your internet boyfriends were secretly internet girlfriends.
I hope so. I really hope so. That would make my life so much more beautiful. I look back when I was like, oh, how old was that? I was like 20. I like went and found one of my internet boyfriends. And he actually was like an incredibly sweet person. So I lucked out. I was like, oh, he's a sweet pie. not a psycho. Not a girl, but could have been. He had the heart of a girl.
Right. I want there to be some sort of like study, like I don't know how to do this kind of mass social study. It'd be fascinating to find out if that's true, that most people who are like on AOL Instant Messenger in like 97 through 2001 were all like female middle schoolers.
I think I just like that's lore now. That is just true. That's true for me forever now. Like, it is lore. It is truth. All of those people that I was, you know, playing weird mud games with and chatting with, and yeah, they were just all girls my same age, but around, and they were all native girls. They're all native girls, like, all around the country.
And none of them actually lived in California.
None of them lived in California, except that Eve girl from the TV show. Amazing. Oh man, so good. Well, I hope your quarantine continues to be wonderful and restful. I hope that your boyfriend learns really good Unity and can, you know, help you feminist processing and
Unity coven.
yeah. And I can't wait to see the VR piece, and I wish good luck to your students. I loved experimental Super 8. Like the class that I took when I was young, learning that, I loved it. So fun. It's so fun when people realize that film is a material, it's tactile, like, oh, it's so beautiful. I hope you can get them to think weirdly about film.
Thank you. I hope so too. I mean, my biggest blessing with this is that literally the week before everybody went on lockdown was the week that they all got to like project their films and see their first like in-camera assignments that they had like hand processed, and they were so excited about it.
Yeah.
It was like a total tragedy because they were so excited to continue and to like learn more and to go deeper into it, but also so exciting that we actually got to see it, because I don't know what I would have done if they like shot everything and then we couldn't watch it. Oh my god, heartbreaking. So I'm so glad of the timing that it worked out, even though we knew it was coming. we had already talked about it in class, like what we were, how crazy the world was. I'm just so glad that they were able to see the magic of like projected film, and that I could even like talk to them about it, because they had no concept of how that worked. Like light shining through something, it was like mind-blowing to them, even just like that little bit. So it was like really beautiful to relive that magic, because they're all painters, like they don't know about video or like media or moving image work at all. And it was like really nice to teach them that a little bit. So hopefully I can continue that magic some other way, but I should stop procrastinating and actually come up with a new plan.
Oh, that's awesome. You're going to figure it out. You'll make something amazing. You'll invent a whole new art form, you know.
Thanks. I hope so.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today and going through multiple microphones. And I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to shout out, or other projects you want people to know about of yours or of other people.
I mean, I guess I didn't talk about the Echo Park Film Center, which is like an amazing place in Los Angeles that provides these kinds of small format analog film resources. And I think nonprofits and small artist communities are so important now to remember that those places are important. We're going through a lot of identity shifts there. And I think like the best thing for me about that place is the community that it's created. And you know, I hope that things like this can continue to exist and thrive in the world, in the new world that we're going to come out into after this quarantine exercise, this like pause isolation. I just think that arts organizations are so important right now, not just art school formally, but like I've had the chance to like teach so many amazing students there in high school and show them film resources, and then they get to go to fancy art schools and be like cooler than everybody else because they already know everything. And just to have those kinds of community resources, so like, I don't know, I guess to give a shout out to the micro cinemas and the small spaces and the artist community spaces that we all are a part of, and how special it is to be a part of those kinds of collectives in this era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, maybe we'll bring back the drive-through, because then we could be all like quarantined in our cars. I used to love the drive-through in Oklahoma.
Oh, that's amazing. We should definitely have a drive-through.
Yeah, I love those. They had the little seeker that would go on the window, and we'd like go and get McDonald's or something on the way, and then like, oh, I loved the drive-in, those.
Or what's even better is like the ones that have the shortwave radio signals.
Yeah.
Your car radio.
Yeah.
Oh man, I could totally organize a drive-through.
We should do it. It would be so great, because no one would have to break their quarantine. They could stay in their car.
Yeah, everybody would still be like isolated and socially distanced. Oh my god, Amelia, this is
crazy. Well, let's do it. Oh my god, I'll drive down to LA to be in your drive-in.
I love this. It's like the drive-thru is the rebirth of the movie watching experience and the of, you know, movies in the time of coronavirus.
Yeah. Maybe it'll still work where you can like put your kids under a blanket so they don't charge you extra. We can still like have that as, you know, if you have a blanket, then they're for free.
Yeah. All the cousins in the back of the truck.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh my god, it's perfect. It's so good.
Yeah.
Anybody talked about this already. It's amazing. You're brilliant.
Just trying to do my part in the world to make it a better place. So.
A true new media pioneer.
Yeah. Old media is the new media. So, you know.
We're rediscovering the chat room. Mm-hmm. Reconnecting on the internet and beyond social media. Like true conversation through the internet. Drive-throughs. So many things.
Yeah. Yeah, this is amazing. Great. Well, I'm glad we solved it all. Thank you so much for chatting with me tonight. And yeah.
I'm honored to be a part of the amazing wampum.codes community. When I saw that you were doing it, I was like, oh man, that's so cool. I wish I could be cool enough to be on that. So thank you for being cool enough.
Thank you so much for coming on. So what I'm doing is April 28th, we're going to be doing a talk at MIT via Zoom, obviously, because everything is via Zoom. And I want everyone who's been on wampum.codes to be invited to come at noon on the 28th, if you're available, of April. And then we will be the spring speakers at the Open Doc Lab at MIT, and it'll just be, you know, we'll all chat with each other, and then that'll be live streamed to their audience, and then I'm going to record it as an episode of wampum.code. So if you're down, it'll be exciting.
That sounds like an incredible dream.
I'm happy because MIT asked me if I wanted to do a panel or a live recording, and I was like, so many of the people who are on wampum.codes is like, I want to meet that other person. So I'm like, yes, we can all just meet and hang out and talk about whatever, and the MIT audience will be there, and then the ISO is going to be involved in, they want to be the audience too, which is the International Screen Office in Canada.